Here's a series of experiments that might be beneficial to perform in order to find out and get to the bottom of this free metal business. Let's imagine, I guess, a core that is iron, solid iron, and copper magnetic winding wire, and magnetizable tape, such as either VCR tape, or probably would be better to use audio cassette tape from the 70s, if you can get it. Or you take the VCR tape and cut it down the middle to make it to get two strands that are more narrow than what they are than the original, which is harder to do. Just to get the audio tape would be easier, because when it's wrapped, because what I'm thinking of is to wrap the tape in numerous places, one of which is around the copper wire before it's wound onto its winding shape. And it's going to be easier to fold the copper magnetic enameled wire into the winding shape if the width of the tape surrounding it is not so wide, so that it doesn't bunch up when it's when the copper wire is wound. So the tape goes around the individual strand of copper wire before it's wound, and then afterwards the whole bundle probably would be a good idea to be taped up at right angles to the winding, because it's also at right angles to the wire, the length of the wires, and so at right angles to the winding, and then the winding placed on the iron core, so that the copper bundle, the iron winding around the copper bundle is in communication with the core. Now, there's a third winding which would represent the pickup coil of Nathan Stubblefield's device, and I would assume that third winding is aluminum wire, not copper. Well, thing of it is, there's so many possibilities to this. I'm trying to keep it narrowed down to just a few so that I don't make a nightmare for you guys in finding out what happens among the different permutations of possibilities, because there is a lot of permutations at maximum. You know, change the core, change the wire used, change the tape used. And where do you put the tape? And do you put the winding on a bobbin, or do you put it directly on the core? And then the possibility is all the different types of experiments to perform with this unique transformer. Do you make two windings rather than one, wound together, of two coils? And do you connect the coils, or treat the transformer as an isolation transformer, or treat it as a shorted transformer, shorted on both terminals of each coil? And versus, do you make, or also, do you make one coil less winding than the other, or do you make them the same number of windings? See, what does that leave? Oh, I think there's one missing. And if the windings, if the two coils are of different windings, different size windings, or a different number of windings, which one do you make primary, which one do you make secondary? So there's all these different permutations or combinations possible, and it might be the only way to get down to the bottom of this thing of what is a trimetal generator? What does it constitute? What's the definition? What is its defining description that describes how it, or determines how it functions? Because that'll determine how it functions, if it functions at all, in any kind of distinct manner, one version versus another. I think that's the only way to approach this, because then the circuit you attach to it is superfluous in as much as it's a consequence of these combinations or permutations, how to best take advantage of each one. So I think that the structure of this thing comes first, and the circuit is secondary. It's not superfluous, but it's secondary. It's dependent upon the structure, the arrangement of all the parts. Now I'm assuming, I'm assuming two different versions in the main. Is the third material of construction a tape surrounding the wire, or is it a third coil? Or are the two main coils the same, or are they different? If they're different, I'm hoping there's only two possibilities. One is copper, the other is iron, but I would think the purpose of the iron is to make sure you don't lose the magnetic field, and so I would assume it's the tape that is the iron. But that leaves in question whether or not there is another tape made of aluminum, and whether or not the core is made of aluminum versus iron. So actually that's two possibilities for tape and two possibilities for core, and then two or three possibilities for the winding wire. So all of the winding wire is copper, or the primary versus the secondary is either copper or iron. Is there a third winding of aluminum, or is it copper? Because I would suspect when Nathan Supplefield, I can't remember the patent. I'd have to reread the patent, but does the patent specify that the third winding is copper? We already know that the core is made up of two windings, one of copper, one of iron. But see, what he did, can we do it better? John Bonini would always say, do it exactly the same before you vary it. But could it be that what he's trying to do is make do? We have magnetic tape, which might be more efficient than trying to checkerboard's pattern interspersed among the copper windings. Every other wire surrounding each copper wire is iron, to serve the purpose, to replace the fact that he did not make use of magnetic tape to wind around the individual strand of copper wire. And he didn't have a transformer situation, because the iron winding, the iron wire wrapped along with the copper wire, is not a transformer situation. It's simply what we would consider to be iron tape surrounding the copper winding of a single copper winding around the iron core of not a transformer, in the sense, because normally a transformer, you put the primary and secondary as close together as possible. I mean, don't you? Or do you put them on opposite sides of an iron armature? Well, he's got them separated. He doesn't. If we consider that the pickup coil is copper, then he does have a transformer, but the two windings are separated from each other, or I should say, alongside each other, but not intermixed, interwound together. Maybe he doesn't have to put them together because he has so much iron to couple them together, surrounding each one. He's trying to make sure that the pickup coil is the smaller of the two, between the two, as opposed to the main copper winding, which is around the core, interspersed with its own set of iron windings. So it would appear that it was more important to him that the copper winding that goes with the iron winding is in maximum communication, magnetic communication with the iron core. Meanwhile, the pickup coil, he's not too concerned about it, because as I recall, he didn't put any iron wire wound together with the pickup coil copper winding. it was strictly copper wire on the pickup coil. So the only thing he wants in communication with the iron bolt core is the main, the larger of the two copper windings that is wrapped with the iron wire around the core for some reason. So he's got a different magnetic coupling already now between the larger copper winding and the smaller versus the core material. So that means your iron, so he's got two sets of iron copper mutual inductance. Because the core is iron and the two windings are copper. So he's got one is greater and the other is lesser. And the greater coupling is between the core and the larger winding versus the smaller winding is lesser coupling with the iron core. So actually he may not have used aluminum at all in the construction. It was simply there in the soil surrounding this whole contraption and getting into it over the course of a year as water would, you know, water seepage and I would imagine aluminum ions would get in there in between everything as the soil dissolved due to the slight acidity of the rainwater and the acidity of the tannic acid coming out of the roots of the oak tree that this was buried underneath. So this might be what people are missing when they immerse his experiment in a bath of water. Now, I don't know if they add salt, but do they add hydrochloric acid or sulfuric acid instead of salt? Or do they add an acidic salt? For instance, let's see, one of these salts, I think they're phosphate salts, or even a sulfate salt, in which only one of the positions of the sulfate salt is taken up. In other words, you don't have an Epsom salt, you have a sodium acid sulfate salt, for instance. So you've got one hydrogen ion and one sodium ion, so it's not completely sulfuric acid. It's a mild acid salt that you've got in the liquid. That might be more appropriate presume to be an analog to what might be happening in nature. But it's a man-made situation rather than, okay, do we find ourselves an oak tree and wait a year? No, let's do a little quicker. Let's create a bath and put it in the bath and decide what electrolyte to put in the bath before we immerse our contraption. So I would guess a sodium acid sulfate salt would be an electrolyte to pick. So we have both a mineral alkali and of one valence, such as sodium, and then hydrogen, and then a double valence acid, such as sulfate, sulfuric acid. Phosphate gets a little too complicated. Or does it? I don't know. Actually, there is there's a dipotassium salt of phosphate on Venus, NASA discovered. And that's actually the silver ratio. There's calcium sulfate on Mars, gypsum, but that's fully saturated. They're fully alkalized. There's no hydrogen ions left over. So I guess there's different ways of approaching this problem. Do we use a phosphate salt or a sulfate salt? I can't imagine any other kind of salt to play around with. But I think it should be mixed, partly alkaline, partly acid, so as to quickly degrade this thing, not have to wait a year, but not totally turn it into soup. You know, not to use sulfuric acid, but to use an acidic salt. And I don't know, that's just an idea, whatever it's worth. Let's see, so, Oh, and then you'd have to use clay.
Ooh.
You know, it might just be better to use clay. You know, take some aluminosilicate clay. And then use a mild acid. Now, rainwater tends to be composed of a slight amount of nitric acid, as I recall, that forms as the rain falls. And then there's bicarbonates as well, to a lesser degree, a milder acid. So there's a combination of two acids. Now, there's actually a small amount of sulfuric acid, now that I think of it, depending on the location. Usually there's not too much because, of course, that is man-made and tends to poison the fish in the lakes and the streams. So it's mostly composed of nitric acid because that's what feeds the plants, nitrogen, and bicarbonation. So that's probably the only two acids that should be present in the distilled water. There's a slight amount of nitric acid and a slight greater amount of carbonic acid, because that's going to be the milder of the two acids. And that'll work away at the materials of construction. It might be useful, though, to provide something else in addition to the clay material, such as feldspar gravel, to provide the potassium and silicate ions. Although feldspar actually provides also sodium, I think, not just... there are different varieties, I think, of feldspar. So maybe feldspar gravel that contains either a potassium alone or a mixture of potassium and sodium and possibly a magnesium ions as well as silicate ions. You know, something to mimic soil that has something other than just merely clay alone, not just pure clay. Oh boy. And then I guess you have to let it sit a while, although if you heat it up, now it gets interesting. If you heat this thing up, will it dissolve more quickly so that you shorten your chemistry experiment or preparatory experiment so you don't have to wait a year? And do you shake it with a vibration, a mechanical shaking, to help all the ions move around, yada yada. It is what I'm thinking along the lines of. And then you have to perform your experiment or series of experiments to see what differing results. So what I'm imagining is you have to think through how to maximize your distinct informational outcomes while at the same time minimizing the number of experiments the permutations and combinations of experiments you have to perform in order to get your distinctly different batches of information that are going to be unique from each other so that you can assess what transpires, and consequently, what kind of circuitry are you going to hook up to this thing, if any? Because I wanted to imagine that in his later days of developing this thing, he might have changed or added a circuitry that he never had before attached to this device to make use of it. Because he did things differently, right? He didn't use arc lanterns hung in the trees anymore. He produced ambient lighting suffused everywhere coming out of the air above the ground. And then he had his heater in the cabin at the same time, which might be in parallel with these changes that he made. He may have had the pithball device to register when somebody comes on his property initially during the first phase, but maybe not in the second because it wouldn't work. Or for that matter, it was not needed, because just the suffusion, the lit up air, might also serve as a tactile connection with the entire environment, creating a singularity. Because if the light is coming from everywhere simultaneously, that means the space of his whole property is a singularity, which means you can't do the pith ball experiment anymore because you don't need it, because the whole space is a singularity in union with itself, because the light is coming from everywhere. But he needed to convert that into heat, and specifically inside his cabin, to concentrate it, because maybe it wasn't that much. So he needed it to build up and accumulate inside his cabin. And so he put his two polished plates inside the cabin to convert this singularity of vibration into heat and accumulate it in one place where he can make use of it in a practical manner that would make sense. And the total surface area of either one of those plates, although they probably were matched, is how much surface area you would need to create how much heat you need in order to heat up a cabin just to the right temperature that would be correct for body comfort, I would imagine. And I also preferred to imagine that one plate is floating and the other plate is connected with a single wire to his generator. That's what I wanted to suspect was taking place. Because it's quite possible that when he had, prior to all of this, during the first phase of his experimentation, when he had the arc lanterns hanging in the tree and a single wire going to it, that single wire went to one carbon rod, but the other carbon rod may have been isolated from the lantern itself, electrically isolated, so as to cause it to be a floating rod and not electrically connected to the lantern, because the lantern is holding these rods in place, and so they're both electrically connected to the lantern, but maybe he isolated one and either connected to that one or connected to the lantern and the rod that was, you know, in order to distinguish one rod from the other, you know, electrically speaking, since I don't think magnetism had anything to do with how the arc lantern operated, it all had to do with electrical connections. And so do you isolate one rod, electrically isolate it from the lantern body, versus the other rod, which is not? You know, do you wrap insulation around the carbon rod? And because it's a single wire connection technology, does that imply or impose or convey as a consequence the possibility or the fact, if it is a fact, that the carbon rods do not deteriorate over time like they normally would, because we don't have a current to cause the deterioration to occur, because it's not a two-wire connection to the rods, it's a single-wire connection to maybe just one of them. So it's possible your rods last forever. That's what I would have to presume under the circumstances, not knowing any better. It's not a hunch, it's just a rationalization of trying to think it through. Because one of the things that Krishnamurti likes to say in his autobiography is, the problem with us humanity is we don't take any thought to its complete conclusion. And I guess when you think about it, coming from a guy who had to suffer through the unforgivable sin during that last lifetime of his, yeah, he's going to himself, damning it, if I only had thought first before I acted, and not just thought halfway, because, you know, maybe he thought, well, maybe this, maybe that, oh, I'll go ahead and do it, instead of thinking everything through. You know, how many times do I get this intuition that somebody's going to die? For instance, I'll give you an example. My uncle was about to die, and I didn't know that. The hunch I was getting in 1987 was somebody was going to die in the family. Okay, so I kept, okay, well, who's going to die? So I went over the possibilities. Me? No. The answer came back, no, that doesn't feel right. Okay. My stepdad? No. My mom? No. And then I stopped. Had I asked the question, is my maternal uncle going to die, I would have found out. But no, I stopped short. And this is a problem that the rabbis have, a gripe they have against Abraham. When the angels of death came to him and said, well, we're going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah because of its evil ways. Should we do it? Abraham. And Abraham, you know, argues with him. Well, what if you only find, what if you find 100 good people? Don't destroy it if you find 100. Okay, we won't do it. Well, what if you find 10 good people and don't destroy it? Okay, we won't destroy it. Well, the rabbis complain, why didn't he go further? If you find only one good man, don't destroy it. Why did he stop at 10? Because there was only one good man, it turned out, anyway. So this is the necessity of being exhaustive when we consider our different options, not to leave anything to chance or clouded vision, or you know, it's like, oh boy, it really makes for a lot of work. And so I'm trying not to make a lot of work for you guys, because it's to exhaust all these possibilities and to find out what's going on. I'm sure it does not require that you exhaust all possibilities. I would like to hope to think that it does not require exhausting all possibilities, because it's a lot of work. You know, initially I thought of all the different factors. Where do you put the tape? And is the core made of aluminum, or is the tape made of aluminum, or yada yada. It came out to something like 6 different possibilities per power of 3, which means it's a digit number in base 3 of 6 digits. And then you find out what all those permutations are, and it's like, good God, no way are they going to want to deal with that. Now let's go back to what Nathan Summerfield did and stick with that and try to reduce the number of options. So this is my line of reasoning that I think is possibly the only next step to find out about this trimetal generator, because it's the only thing we know. I mean, I know it exists, even though Jim Murray, when I went to the 2015 conference and I asked him to his face, what is the story of William Lyon? And William Lyon was there. He was there at the 2013 conference when I was there, and he was there at the 2015 conference. So I got to meet him in person twice. And I conferred with him by email a few times. And he's convinced about these stories that he relayed to us in his Pentagon Aliens book, let alone his other books. And this story of the trimetal generator that Dort Jr. spoke of, but we don't know anything about it. Yet I know this friend of my electrician guy who put the plug in, the RV camp 240-volt plug up in Washington State for me so I could recharge my car. He met somebody who built and operated such a device. So I know it exists, yet Jim Murray's flat to my face said, no, it's a fiction, it's a fantasy, don't believe in it. And I sat down in my chair so depressed. I felt horrible. But, and I know Aaron can't do as much as he would like to do. It's pretty obvious that he's being watched, and he has to be very careful the nature of the presentations that are presented. Because I've gotten complaints from people telling me, I'm not satisfied with what presentations are put on by Aaron. It's like all they do is tease the audience without actually giving us all the nitty-gritty details. They just tease us and make us hungry for more. Now, I don't know if that's a psychological ploy, to prompt us to find out on our own, because that's what's going to be the case anyway. Or is it because Aaron can't do anything more because he's being watched? And in order to operate at all and be successful, he's got to hold back. Anywho, be it that as it may, for whatever reason Jim Murray had for saying what he had to say, I'm convinced otherwise, because of the 3 types of magnetism that are being exhibited by those through 3 materials of construction. And once you get them coordinated with each other, they must have a different impact depending on how you use them in a singular item of interest, such as a transformer or a motor winding if it's a single coil. So anyway, I can't imagine it not being true, that it doesn't exist. And it's the only way I can explain, as I've said to you already, Bob, that it's the only way that I can explain how these mathematical proportionalities that are unique to each other, these three mutual inductances, how they can operate and keep track of each other, because their three different magnetic fields are interspersed and intermixed with each other. How do they keep track of each other? Well, each one has to be unique in how it behaves, not its strength, because the strengths, see, the simulator, I tell the simulator the strength, right? And it has to be exactly on the number, it can't vary. It has to be good to two digits of percentage exact. But in reality, it could be the style of magnetism, paramagnetism versus diamagnetism versus ferromagnetism. That's what is actually happening to determine the uniqueness of each magnetic field. While the simulator, I can't tell it that because it's just a simple simulator. It's not an ANSYS simulator. It's just a MicroCap or a LTSpice or a Paul Falstad simulator, which can't tell the difference between the materials of construction, because you can't tell it, so it can't tell the difference. So all you can do in the case of MicroCap, which allows for multiply unique mutual inductances, you get to put that in and then wonder what that means in terms of a real-world build. And so I'm thinking that's the only way to translate and interpret what that means are three different substances of the materials of this construction that end up giving you those three different mutual inductances, so that you don't have to worry about them. That was the whole point of my thinking to myself, well, this doesn't make any sense because you can't build it in any practical sense, but you have to because it's there as a possibility, so there has to be a way to do it. You know, I'm a person who doesn't give up, who always believes there's an option that makes something possible that seems impossible, or else the thought wouldn't be there. In other words, if you can think it, you can do it. If you can't think it, then you can't do it. But if you can think it, you're already halfway there. All you have to do is figure out how to do it. And you can't take impossibility or failure as an option. You can't accept that. You cannot accept that. So that's what led me to presume that it must be the trimetal generator that is what I stumbled on when I recognized what this mathematical difference among three mutual inductances and how precise they are. It must be that that three different substances, metallic substances, are involved. Or in the case of Nathan Stubblefield, three degraded metallic substances are involved. As the only way to explain what I stumbled on. I mean, I can't think of any other explanation, because if I start thinking of, well, these sets of coils have to have a certain spacing, and then these other coils have to have a different spacing, that's another way to interpret it. But the spacing has to be so precise as to seem ridiculously anal to try and get it exactly the way the distancing it has to be. And yet, Donald Smith, from all appearances, all of his coils were made of the same construction, yet they had different spacing. So there may be, and then there's the thought that comes to mind, well, what about the base that the coils were standing on? Did that have something to do? Was that, did he choose aluminum as his base? I don't recall. To serve as that third metallic substance. So that he was already kind of doing a sum of both, but not completely one or the other. So he only had aluminum and copper, but no iron present. So then he made up the difference by spacing them. You know, I don't know. There may be different ways of doing this, or maybe only one way, or maybe not, maybe a couple of ways, to exhibit the trimetal characteristic without having to use all three metals. Because it is a question of magnetism and of mutual inductance alone, because that's all the simulation is telling me. But the translation of that may be more than one variety when it comes to building it and making it manifest physically. You know who might be good to get involved with this is Ken Wheeler. Isn't he the guy who wrote the book on magnetism? He's got the, you know, tattoos all over his body, and he's not skinny. And he gave presentations, a few of them, at the Aaron's conference. Wouldn't he be the right person to ask? Because he seems to be so well endowed with knowledge about magnetism. I bet he would be the person to ask to confer with on this. It's good that I'm contributing something about three different mutual inductances, but if it has anything to do with magnetism, and I'm sure it does, because it is, he'd be the guy to confer with this. I never thought of this. Now that I think of it, he's the guy to ask, to try to figure more out about this, because we know so little, but at least now we have some clues. I'm pretty sure Nathan Stubblefield read one of Tesla's patents before it disappeared off of public purview. Public access, along with the Amon brothers, and it may be one and the same device, the same patent that they both were doing different versions of. You know, each did their own version of manifestation, because it sure to me it sounds like it is the same. It is some because they the Amon brothers had copper tubing, a brass or a brass. globes, whatever it was, some copper derivative, and then they had iron. And then if they made use of diodes the way they made diodes back then, a century ago, there would have been aluminum involved, because that's how you made diodes in those days. They didn't have vacuum tubes, they didn't have germanium diodes, or they might have had cat whisker diodes, but there is a technique for making diodes that involves the use of aluminum. And that might be the only place where the aluminum is located, is in the use of diodes in this contraption, you know, along with this contraption. Because your cathode is aluminum, and then your anode is something else other than aluminum. And although traditionally, I think historically, they used, iron, I think, as the anode. I'm thinking bismuth. B-I-S-M-U-T-H. It's next door to lead on the periodic chart. Might be an interesting substance to use for the anode. In any case, the cathode is aluminum. And it has to be different from the anode. And then you use a bath, an electrolytic, or seemingly, but it's not really an electrolytic bath, because you're using either baking soda solution or borax solution, which is not electrolytic. It allows for ion flow in only one direction. And then you put AC through this thing, and it conditions your aluminum by causing a layer of aluminum oxide to form on the surface of your aluminum. So you're doing what Nathan Stubblefield did. You're degrading the aluminum to create aluminum oxide in the solution and coating the exterior of the aluminum cathode. So then you get one-way direction of current while the voltage can go still continue to go both ways. And that might be where the aluminum is located and why Nathan Stubblefield didn't bother and just used the soil. Because if he had another, let's say, a grounding rod set up somewhere nearby, then it would be passing through the soil, and the soil might act in a diodic fashion, possibly. I don't know. You know, when he did his telephony through the earth, is that what the aluminum content of the soil does, act as a diode? I don't know. Or do you have to encourage it by using an aluminum rod that goes into the ground? While one rod is aluminum, the other one is copper. And now you've got yourself an aluminum-based diode right there. Because the aluminum oxide is going to form on one of those two grounding rods. So there's a myriad of situations to try to interpret how does aluminum fit into the situation. It may have nothing to do with the winding or the construction of the transformer at all. That we merely use iron to increase the coupling, the magnetic field coupling the coupling between the magnetic field and the copper winding as much as we can do so. In other words, we do what Oliver Heaviside was suggesting, and we don't do anything more. We just do that alone and nothing else. But we still need to figure out where the aluminum goes, and it could be a dyadic situation. It may have nothing to do with magnetism. It may have to do with electricity, the flow of electricity. Now, I don't know, if you construct this type of aluminum diode or this type of diode, is it different than the behavioral characteristics of our modern-day diodes? Would that make a difference? So, you know, these are questions we have to pose because we don't know all the answers, and it's not good to assume anything. You know, one thing I learned as a four-year-old, don't assume anything. Because we don't know everything, and we don't know what we don't know. So, don't assume everything. Although it's worthwhile to speculate, that's true, but you'd better darn use your intuition to make up the difference, because there's no way you're going to be able to speculate all possibilities and figure it all out. Yet when I do my work on the simulator, that's exactly what I have to do, and it's so exhaustive because the simulator can't tell me, well, try this. Why don't you try that? You haven't tried this yet. I have to come up with that idea, not the simulator. So this is something to think about. You know, what is it about this trimetal generator that makes it so difficult to understand? Well, we have to get our head in the historical reference frame of 100 years ago and think the way they thought. What are the ideas that they passed around among each other? Because they borrowed from each other. Come on, Tesla didn't live in a vacuum any more than the Amon brothers or Nathan Stubblefield. They learned from each other. So if we think in terms of the way inventors thought 100 years ago, what did they have available to work with? And what did they do to solve certain problems? And so Oliver Heaviside has to be added in there, along with Nathan Stubblefield and the Amon brothers and Tesla, all of them, because they all approached the problem in the same manner, more or less. Even though they might have done it in a different way, specifically, in their own unique way, they still grappled with the same problems and endeavored, as their goal, to solve the same problems.